the minute you finish the workout up to, say, 72 hours, that's what I call the weakness window. And what do you do during this weakness window? Well, what you should do is rest. But what people do is they work out doing something else. They go for a run. That's a terrible thing to do because they're going for a run in a state where their muscles are weak and it affects their gait, their muscle balance, their muscle function, their posture when they stop. And of course, that's a problem.
Path Projects, my favorite gear of the year when it comes to putting on something new.
And we're still at the very beginning of 2021. What path are you on? See how I worked that Path Projects into the conversation there, Freeman?
You're using up their valuable time, Scott. Let's get to tell them how much we love putting their gear on.
They have shorts, they have baseliners, they have the independent suspension. So they're not combined like those other shorts. You put the baseliner on, then you put the shorts. And what does that translate into? Zero chafing. And that's one thing that you want to take out of the equation when you're out on a long run.
Well, not just the chafing, Scott, just the comfort. What if you're on a run that doesn't have chafing involved? What if you just want to feel good?
And move good. And the materials they use are high quality. That's the reason they do their business model the way they do. It's direct to consumer so that you don't have to pay $250 for a pair of shorts.
So it's basically like being a store owner and just ordering from the supplier. You're in that position.
And you have an expert telling you what materials and what design to wear. The designs are perfect. I still love the pockets where they are. They're just amazing.
You've got one of the big Apple phones, and I see it riding happily in your back pocket as I'm following you.
Sometimes I forget it's there. Go to pathprojects.com and check out their good stuff. Start your year out right with some Path Projects.
No, don't start recording yet.
That's really out of my pay grade.
People, Don did not prep, and I think there are a few more bullet points that we'll be discussing.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman,
and I'm Scott Warren, and we have one of our most popular guests back on the show after a long while. And we're going to talk about why he hasn't been back, because he's been traveling the world and just be learning and becoming a better version of himself. We have Dr. Phil Maffetone with us.
I thought it was because you didn't reach out to me. I didn't hear from you guys. And I was beginning to wonder, you know, don't they love me anymore? You know, it's...
Oh, no. The love has never ceased. Okay. And the admiration is always still there.
Thanks for for having me on. This is always a treat, a pleasure, and lots of fun.
We're going to talk today about strength and why strength is important. But if you don't know Dr. Phil, he has been on the podcast a number of times. You need to go back and listen to those episodes. I would bet he's probably north of a dozen episodes that he's recorded with us, written a lot of really good books that all of them should be on your bookshelf in your library of health and running.
We've referred to him, Scott. Let me drop a few of those titles for you. The Big Yellow Book, which you'll never find the Big Yellow Book, but it is yellow on the cover, and the title is Endurance Training and Racing. The Big Red Book, although that's not the official name of the book, it is a red cover, and it's Health and Fitness. He's written Over Fat Pandemic. He's written The Million Dollar Marathon, Healthy Brains and Healthy Children, The Endurance Handbook. He wrote 159, predicting when the marathon, the two-hour marathon, would be broke without the aid of pacers that are breaking the wind and a line to follow around the course. So he digs deep into that, and he has a new book out too that we want to discuss. It's called Get Strong. And before the podcast, Dr. Phil, we thought we would try to guess what Get Strong was about. So we haven't, I mean, the book's so new, we don't have it in our hands, but you know, we don't need it because we have the author on the line here. So Scott, what was your guess of what Get Strong was about?
Well, as always, anything that I hear, I have to
bring it back to me because I'm a very selfish person.
Yeah.
And when I heard that, I was automatically accused by Dr. Phil of not doing enough cross training and having strength. I'm kind of in a good zone right now where I'm being pretty diligent with my running, but I'm not including good strength training. And so that's what I think it is, about getting strong.
Oh, you got it. You win, Don. Don, you can't even guess and risk being wrong because.
But I don't have to guess. Well, you know, I'm a generous friend to Scott. You know, I let him take the easy swing,
the obvious.
I'm going to try to hit the high inside fastball here. And if I would have had to guess, what was left for me to guess? Because Scott took the pitch right down the plate. I would have said, you know, strength is really about everything that wraps around the sport. I mean, it comes with sleep. It comes with nutrition. It comes with just a positive attitude. And I think getting strong is about supporting all elements around your life so that when it comes to your sport or your passion, you can go out and knock it out of the park. I'll stay with my baseball metaphor here.
That's good. And certainly all those factors support strength. And like they do endurance, and so you get equal credit for that holistic observation.
Okay, thank you.
So, how is this book different than the 10,000 other books on strength training out there?
It's totally different. The 10,000 other books talk about essentially the same thing, which is traditional weightlifting. And I have to admit, I haven't read all 10,000 of them. But when you look on Amazon, or if you walk into a bookstore that has a lot of strength books, you'll see basically the same type of thing, which is the traditional approach to getting strong, which is the old 1950s, 1960s, go to the gym, lift weights, recover for 2 days, and then come back and lift weights again. And what you're doing is you're lifting weights to fatigue. And if you have some coach there, your coach is saying, come on, one more, you could do one more, and, you know, that kind of thing. And you watch yourself in the mirror and blah, blah, blah. And what that does is it bulks you up, so you look cool, without a doubt. You look more cool. That's why there are mirrors in these places. However, you may not be getting stronger, interestingly enough, and you may, more than likely, are not strengthening your bones at the same time you're strengthening your muscles.
Well, yeah, you know, you're probably not, because I was caught up in that trap back in the, you know, a decade or so before I became a runner. I was into the mirror analysis and doing those things and competed in some bodybuilding stuff. And you are building just the show muscles, the big ones, and a lot of the stabilization muscles that are very important are being neglected. Now, certainly to do those weights, you need, in defense of my comment, you need some stabilization. If you're using dumbbells and things, there has to be some stabilization. But I don't think in the same as getting out there and doing ground-based dynamic movements that are just real to gravity and to the surface on the planet. I think that builds more strength. You end up with a stronger body. A gymnast is stronger than a bodybuilder.
Sure. Bodybuilders are often quite weak, in fact. And the real difference between a big muscle and a little muscle is, or the difference between a big muscle that's not as strong as a little muscle, is that the little muscle can contract more muscle fibers. And so you sometimes have these skinny people who have a lot of strength. I have very good strength, and I don't have big muscles. And the important component is that get strong. The approach that I've taken over the years is that we want to get the brain to contract more muscle fibers in the muscles so that you can get strong. It's really that simple. And it really came, in part, it came from my work with biofeedback, where we would be working with a person whose muscles or who had a muscle that was totally impaired, totally weak. Someone with a stroke, for example, or a brain injured child who was born with a flaccid muscle. And what's happening is the brain is unable to find all those fibers. And with manual biofeedback, you can do that quite quickly. And with Get Strong, you know, I talk about the fact that one workout will begin to make you strong, as opposed to a traditional weightlifting approach, which one workout actually makes you weak.
So how do we do this? What is this a workout book, or is it more of a philosophical book?
It's neither one. And I've never written a workout book. You know, I recently had a really great video program called MAF Walking, which we launched a few weeks ago. And the very first person who gosh, I hope he's not listening, who bought this program, watched it and immediately emailed back and said, I want my money back because I thought this was a program. Well, we knew what he was saying. I thought you were going to give me on Monday, you do this, on Tuesday, you do that. You walk this many miles at this pace. You put your right foot in front of your left foot and then you move your left, you know. I've never done that. And I've had so many people in my career that have said, yeah, but what is the program? I said, there's no program because it's personalized. You have to make it. Here are all the tools you need to make it. And so what Get Strong is all about is giving people an understanding of how they can get stronger. And it's really so simple that I think it might even turn people off because it's so simple, because they're so used to these complex workouts that you know, you go from this machine to that machine and there's 15 different muscles you need to get, you know. No, if you just pick something up off the ground and lift it up to your chest, above your head if you want, you don't even have to lift it up to your chest. Just pick something up off the ground, do some squats, put it back down. You've done about as much strength training as you can do with any other workout. How easy does it get?
So when we think about the traditional get big, get strong, make muscle, it's all about these sayings, no pain, no gain. You really have to be so sore that you really know that you've done the job to make yourself strong. Is this wrong thinking?
Well, it's wrong thinking if your goal is to strengthen your muscles and bones. And if you're an endurance athlete, if your goal is to be able to run faster, if you're going to add bulk, you're going to add weight, and that's going to actually slow you down. It's wrong thinking unless you want to look really cool. And I could understand that, but we still can't neglect our strength, because strength is as important as endurance from a health standpoint, from a mortality standpoint. We lose muscle and bone, from about, you know, beginning mid to late 20s. We start losing muscle and bone, and we can slow that process significantly. We can maintain strength quite well until, you know, way later in life and into our 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 100. We're not going to be as strong at 90 as we were at 40, obviously, but the strength we'll have at 90 if we apply these methods will be more than adequate to have will be more than adequate to maintain maintain health. As we lose muscle and as we get weaker, you know, it's not just we're more vulnerable to falls and other accidents, but it affects our circulation, our cardiovascular system, of course, bone health, and fractures are common problems, and on. And it really touches on every system of the body. So we're not just talking about, you know, being strong enough to pick up a couple of paint cans when you're 80 years old. We're talking about optimal health and fitness.
When you mentioned earlier about if you have extra bulk, you don't want to carry that along the trail. I mean, just so you can look cool, you don't need the extra size shoulders or biceps, etc. And that made me start to think about, you know, Tour de France athletes. They have really skinny spaghetti arms, but they've got thighs that look like they could crush, you know, anything that they're stepping on. Really big, efficient muscle down below, but they don't need anything up top because they're just holding onto a handlebar.
Sure.
What should a runner look like? Should we have any upper body? Should we be balanced? What's the physique of a runner ideally in your mind?
Well, we need to be balanced, that's for sure. And when we start isolating muscles and building a muscle because somebody says, "Hey, you've got a history of back problems, so you need to do a lot of sit-ups," that can really backfire quickly. And you know, if you have this problem, you should do these kinds of weightlifting exercises. I think we need to be balanced, and that means not building bulk for the sake of building bulk. We can, you know, look at, for example, 5K runners and how high they can jump from a standing in place vertical jump. You know, we're talking about 2 or 3 feet. These people are amazing with their jumping ability, and that's strictly because they have good strength. As they move up to the 10K and beyond, and certainly by the marathon, if they're not keeping up with strength training, they now can barely get to 8, 9, 10 inches of jumping vertical height, which is really sad because it not only means you're not strong anymore, muscle and bone strength, but it also means it's going to impair your race performance. And so it's really, you know, it's going to do so much for you in performance as much as it's going to benefit your health.
So do you think that we're sabotaging ourselves as distance runners of Marathon Plus up to whatever you can find on your ultra sign-up chart by not dipping our toe into the 5K? Essentially, the 5K could be some strength training for us because we get out there and have to do more explosive type of running. I mean, heck, I think I've run some of the longer distances without ever leaving the ground, you know, always a foot somewhere on the ground. So that's not explosive strength. So maybe someone that's always running 50 mile or better and looking at that because that's what a quote unquote real trail runner does, which is, you know, not true, that they should dip down into the 5K and not expect to do as well as they place in their own genre of the longer runs, setting their ego aside and just signing up for a 5K, calling it a strength day and going out there and experience that kind of race.
I'm not sure it works that way. I'm not sure you can go back to your younger days and pretend you're 18, 20 years of age and you can, vertically jump 2.5 feet, and you happen to be running a 5K. I think the ability to jump vertically 2.5 feet is a sign of strength, which means you could run a better 5K. So the strength has to come first. And that power, that sheer speed coming out of your youth is part of that natural development of speed. And, you know, eventually you peak out at age, whatever, 25 and, you know, 28, whatever. And then you start, diminishing that. And that's where we need to go in and do some strength training that will maintain that strength for as long as we can. And we can do it for quite a while. For the endurance athlete now, who's, you know, going out and running 20, 30, 40 miles on some regular basis or competing at that level, it's interesting because what we talked about weightlifters sometimes being weak, endurance athletes are notoriously weak. Mm. And all you have to do is look at the data on the jump, vertical jump heights on endurance athlete, and you'll see how bad it typically is. And so doing that, adding strength, being able to jump higher will make you a better ultra endurance athlete as well.
I think I'm not unique that most of us feel that we need to be stronger. How can this book help me? So we've talked about the importance of being stronger, and this isn't a workout book, but can you give me some tips if I wanted to go out tomorrow and say, make the commitment that I want to be a stronger runner? Is it doing some more speed work? Is that the strength? Doing some hill repeats? Is it like Don likes to do when he goes running with Bob Crowley? When they get to the bottom of the hill, they do 20, 30 push-ups. And then when we get to the top of the hill, they do 20 or 30 push-ups. How can I become stronger, Phil?
Well, the track workouts are not going to do that. You might get a little strength for those distances that you're working out in. But in terms of muscle strength and bone strength, it really isn't going to happen. And so you need to do what all of our ancestors have done, or what our ancestors have done. We have common ancestors, which is go out into the woods and grab a big log and pick it up and walk home with it. Or go out and find a bunch of big rocks and lift them up and slowly, you know, carry it for 10 feet and then drop it and rest and then pick it up again. Of course, people are not going to do that. I love doing that. It's a fun thing for me. But we can mimic that action because that's the action that humans have used to maintain strength throughout their lifetimes. And so we can mimic that, and we do it the simplest way. And in the book, I do give examples of what kind of a workout will do this. What do you mean one single movement is going to give you strength? Well, that one single movement is what I mentioned earlier. You're going to pick up a weight from the ground. So you're going to have a barbell there on the floor. You're going to properly squat down and grab it and pick it up, and then you're going to do maybe five squats, and then put it back down. And really, that could be your workout for the moment. Now, what I also do is give people the option of doing something called slow weights, which is something I've been doing for a long, long time, which is where you have a barbell in the corner of your office or your living room, and every time you go by or every time you think of it, you walk over there, you pick it up, you do six squats, you put it down. And if you're waiting for a phone call, you run over there and you do six more squats, and then when the phone rings, you go answer it, and you talk and in the course of a day or in the course of a week, you're doing more training, strength training, than you could if you go to the gym three times a week.
So activities of daily living are just, you know, doing yard work, you know, putting groceries away and doing laundry. That all counts if you are using proper ergonomics. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is working out is cumulative in nature. The stuff you do during the week can say have the same benefit as condensed periods of time that you assign as my workout time.
Exactly. And that's a good point, is that one lift with the six squats that you do maybe once a day, maybe three times a day on a day where you could do it. Maybe you do it four or five times a day. Maybe you don't do it at all that day. But over the course of the week, over the course of the month, you accumulate that brain-muscle connection. And yes, you get those benefits and you get them without stress. You get them without fatigue. You get them without soreness. You never get sore. Which is really important, because soreness means you've fatigued the muscle excessively, and in a workout where you do traditional weight training and you get sore, there's this period of time. It's more than 48 hours. It could be 48 to 72 hours. And during that, from the minute you finish the workout up to, say, 72 hours, that's what I call the weakness window. And what do you do during this weakness window? Well, what you should do is rest. But what people do is they work out doing something else. They go for a run. That's a terrible thing to do, because they're going for a run in a state where their muscles are weak, and it affects their gait, their muscle balance, their muscle function, their posture when they stop. And of course, that's a problem.
My observation may be off, so call me out on it, and I don't mind. It seems like everything that has been coming across our radar has been our ancestors did it. We eat paleo. We do workouts that are intuitive and spontaneous and random, and this is a good thing. Why is it that our ancestors know and knew so much more than we do, that we have access to all this information, all the research we do, and it comes back to, you know, what our ancestors did was the right way. At least that's what we're seeing now. Do you have any thoughts on that, or am I
no, making things up? No, you're absolutely right. They had instincts and intuition, and really it's as simple as that. In my MAF science paper that Paul Larson and I did, I don't know when it was, the end of last year, the very first sentence says our earliest ancestors ate high fat diets that hardly had any carbohydrate. I mean, it's as simple as that. And we have all these functions today that they had, and we think we're smarter, but we've lost our instincts and intuitions. And so the average person is not going to go out and lift logs in the woods and lift stones. Some of them will, but most of them won't. So what can we do that mimics that movement, that mimics that strength building routine? And that's what this book is about.
Well, maybe, you know, I don't want to get into a religious discussion or how we've evolved, but maybe this design that we have is really built for the things that we need to do. You know, so if there was a designer that said, hey, these people need to be able to haul logs back to the fire, they need to chase down an animal, and they need to be able to survive off of what they catch and what can grow seasonally, that really is the design. And now we're saying, oh my, it's not things that we've industrialized. It's really things that we were initially designed to exist and have success.
Sure. Sure. This is how we were made way back when. And mm-hmm. It's really not much different today. Unfortunately, today we have marketing people. Mm-hmm. We have advertising. We have companies wanting to sell you a product, and they're selling you the sizzle. And if you think about what that really is, you're probably not going to buy it. But they advertise it in such a way that you don't think about it. Oh, yeah, run my best marathon, even though I've run 50 of them. Run my best marathon in 2 weeks of training. with this special program. Here's a rubber band. It's expensive because it comes with a very good program, and it'll make you stronger. And, you know, buy this, you know, and as the years go by, your garage accumulates all this junk, and then you have a garage sale. People come by and buy it, and they put it in their garage, and it's an eternal, you know. So, you know, we're so far removed today from nature that we have these kinds of problems. And my whole career has really been based on, let's get back to nature. What did we do when we didn't have marketing people to tell us what we should be eating or what we should be doing with our bodies? Those details are, we don't know everything, but we know an awful lot of what our ancestors did.
Phil, I need some reprogramming because, you know, going through high school, trying to play football as a scrawny little kid, I took a weightlifting class and I was taught the way to become strong. And that was, and we mentioned it earlier, you go into the gym and you work till fatigue or exhaustion, and that soreness is good. Like Don said, no pain, no gain. That pain meant that you had fatigued the muscle, that the lactic acid was now going to go into the muscles, and the muscle then rebuilds itself and it becomes stronger. That's the way that I have been programmed on how to become strong. Now you're telling me that I need this weight over in the corner of my living room, and maybe this is just a kettlebell or something. I don't know if it needs to be really heavy or a really light one. And I go lift it. I don't lift it for exhaustion. I lift it 6 times and boy, that was easy. And then I go eat my avocado sandwich.
Sure. That's in short, yes. Okay. now you're comparing what an adolescent might do in the weight room with what a 30 and over adult might do, which are very different things. But essentially, yes, that no pain, no gain approach is really harmful. Is it good for young people? Well, you know, we have one chance to build our muscles and build our bones, and that chance is through adolescence into our 20s. And if we don't do it then, we don't have another chance. All we can do is help maintain what we have, and we could get stronger. I mean, I know plenty of people who at age 40 are much stronger than they were at age 20. Unfortunately, that's not because of anything that I helped them with. It's because they were so weak when they were 20, they never developed things to begin with. And you're right, Scott, the weight in the corner of the room, yes, that mimics nature, and that's going to give you the ability for your brain to contract more muscle fibers, which is what strength is all about. And the amount of weight in particular is about 80% of your max weight. So if you can lift 100 pounds one time off the ground, then that weight should be about 80 pounds. And at 80 pounds, you should be able to do 6 repetitions of whatever. In this case, the ones I recommend most are the squats, and they don't even have to be real full squats. A half squat is actually just as effective as a full squat. People think, well, you got to go all the way down. Well, no, I've seen so many injuries from that. A half squat is just as effective. You get just as much muscle contraction in a half squat as you do a full squat. But in that example of 100 being the weight you can lift one time, then you're going to be able to do 6 squats holding 80 pounds.
We're going to take a quick break from Dr. Phil to talk about the sunglasses that I wear every time I put on a pair, and that's Gooder.
We're going to talk with media megalodon Shelby Farrell.
And this is part of that discussion about how great these sunglasses really are.
Hey, now, Shelby, I'm very curious about the flamingo because it's ever present whenever you go onto Gooder's site. Tell us about the flamingo and why it's so important at Gooder.
The flamingo was something that came about when our CEO was working on branding, and the first sunglasses that we launched were flamingos on a booze cruise. And really, Carl evolved from there and became Gooder's figurehead. So our brand voice is very much in the voice of Carl. He kind of has this fun, but maybe slightly asshole-y vibe to him.
What is it that you just love about the Gooder glasses? I'm just gonna pitch out there that I think they're light.
They are super lightweight. They don't slip or bounce when you're running. I have actually counted in the past how many times I push up my glasses. And with Gooders, it's zero, maybe once, depending on how sweaty your face is, if you're really moving. But with other glasses, you are constantly pushing them up your nose, adjusting your earbuds, and everything's just a mess. So Gooders really help take that mess out of the equation. You can enjoy your run without fussing with your face.
And Shelby, Gooder has a great deal going on for Trail Runner Nation listeners right now. What is it?
Use the code capital TRN at checkout and score $10, 10 whole dollars off your order. And that's gooder.com/TRN to get that deal.
And now back to our conversation with Dr. Phil Maffetone.
Phil, you have always been a thought leader. You know, things that you promote and suggest for us to consider really have, they fly in the face of status quo, from heart rate to nutrition to, you know, what you're talking about now, getting strong. You've pushed the ball up the hill your whole career. I mean, how has it been to be on that, you know, on that push? Has it been I'm just interested in the life of Dr. Maffetone, of what it's like to be a pusher.
Do you get
thoughts,
bricks thrown through your windows, Phil?
I do. When they can find me. Yes, I do.
That's why you're always moving.
That's why I'm always moving. You know, it's like changing
every time we talk to him.
It's changing your phone number because you get too many spam calls. That's a good question. I have to admit, it can be tiring at times. Early in my career, it was different. It was tiring in a different way. The most common question was, well, how do I do this? And I didn't really focus on here's why you do it. And eventually I said, oh, I better start figuring out why, or putting why into words, so that the people who are more scientific or more clinical than me will not be turned off, because that's what was happening. And that was very helpful. But I don't know the answer, other than it can be tiring at times. But I wouldn't have it any other way. It's been so much fun, and I'm certainly not slowing down.
No, you're not, and you have full respect of the people that are coming behind you to validate your theories, you know, and as your instinct guides you in a direction, and you let your instincts, I think, move you, and you write to and promote what you're feeling. And not that you don't have a scientific position, because you're well trained, well read, and you collaborate with very smart people. But nicely behind you, whether it's a, you know, 5 years or a decade, doesn't matter, people are coming behind that are validating your thoughts, which is like, wow, Phil was right the whole time. Now we're all wearing heart rate monitors. When you started your heart rate work, people were wearing vests that weighed, you know, 20% of their 80% body
weight. 80% of their maximum.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was lecturing at a running camp back in, I want to say 79 or 80. And there was a big macho coach who was kind of running the camp. And I got up and I talked about heart monitors and heart rate and running intensity and all kinds of interesting things, and he got up right after me and said, you don't need a heart monitor, blah blah blah, and really rude, obnoxious military type, not that military people are rude and obnoxious, but really just not a nice guy. And 2 years later, somebody said, hey, did you see so-and-so just wrote a book on heart monitoring? And I just shook my head. What do you say about these things? So, yeah, I think it's nice to see people like Paul Larson, which is why I like working with him, because he's got such a great academic background, and Dan Plews, and other people. It's having fun and helping people. Advertisers don't help people, they hurt people.
Phil, like we were just discussing, you're always pushing the envelope. What is something that you have discovered or been impressed with or went, that's something new. That's something that I've learned. Something in the last year that you thought, that's significant.
And I'm okay if it's within the last 18 okay. months, Dr. Mathedon.
Man, good question. I
what's new coming out of Dr. Phil's brain?
I want to say I don't dwell on the past, because those things sometimes fuel other thoughts, which bring me to the present. What's coming out now? God, I'd have to think about it. I get up in the morning and there's usually something in my head because I've been dreaming about it. I often go right to the computer or pick up a guitar and start writing what I heard during the night. But to ask me what's new, I could tell you there's a lot of new things, but I can't really think of any.
Well, we don't want to destroy the confidentiality of the next book either. So
I think I'm finished. I keep saying this. I know. Enough is enough. This was a nice last book. This was really enjoyable. I've wanted to write this for many, many years. There are other things I want to do. I'm looking at a second addition to Complementary Sports Medicine. That's a new thing that I've been working on. I don't know. I'm as busy as ever, and it's really wonderful.
I'm interested in your thoughts about the early morning thought that comes to your mind, because I'm one of those people too, and I'd like to be better at it. And maybe those that are listening might align themselves with that or like to improve what they're doing, of solving a problem overnight, waking up and with this fresh idea and this, where's my guitar, where's a pen and pencil so I can write this idea. How does a brain work? How does that magic happen when we're unconscious to the world and only loud noises of danger can wake us up to get out of harm's way? How are we able to intricately work through these problems that we can't solve when we're awake and we're really working on it? We stay up late trying to figure it out, and then all of a sudden you wake up and boom, the answer's right there. Can you explain that, or do you have a thought?
Well, generally, our brain is not asleep. Just because we're unconscious, just because we're sleeping, we don't have a conscious. We're not in a conscious state of brain function.
I must be a real simpleton, huh, Dr. Phil? I must be a simpleton to think that we have an off switch and we just shut down.
Well, so. A lot of people think that, and it's just these are the things we should learn in kindergarten, but we don't.
Take me to kindergarten.
So there's a lot going on in our brain during the night, and we may or may not be consciously aware of it when we wake up. But what I like to do, and I choose to do this. This is a routine that people can choose to do. I'll tell you about the alternative in a minute. But what I do is my conscious state appears at some point when I begin to wake up. And I'm typically in a, sometimes I'm in an alpha state where I'm just kind of laying there and I'm kind of dreaming and feeling good. It's like a meditation. Or sometimes I'm in theta. Kids are in theta all the time. And imagine a kid playing with pots and pans, you know, building a spaceship out of these pots and pans. And so this theta state is really wonderful. It's kind of that goofy, cartoony state of consciousness that adults can have too. And we often have it when we're falling asleep, but we can have it when we wake up as well. And so I like to bounce around between alpha and theta early in the morning, and I'll just reside there for a period of time until I've had enough of it. And then I get up and either, you know, grab the pencil or the guitar or go to the computer. And quite often there's something I was working on the day before or the week before. And I've got, it's been like a problem. Okay, here's this mathematical problem. We don't know how to solve it. And all of a sudden, it's been solved during the night. That happens often. It happens to a lot of people when they let it. And it's a very healthy state to be in. The problem we have in our society is people go to bed later than they should. They're sleep deprived. So they don't wake up. Therefore, they need an alarm clock. And you got this obnoxious sound that wakes you up out of some level of sleep, wherever you are. It could be in one of these wonderful states. And all of a sudden, you're stressed. That's not the way to wake up. We should be able to wake up at whatever time we tell ourselves the night before. If I have to, you know, if I have a 6 a.m. podcast or something, I tell myself to be awake at 5. I'm often awake at 5 anyway. But, you know, that ability, we have that ability in the brain, and that's a great way to just help our brain get better and better.
You know, I want to comment on that. I think that's amazing that the brain can do that. I know some days I have some early morning meetings that are hours before I normally wake up. And so I want to make sure that I'm there. And so I set a couple of alarms. But interestingly enough, if I tell myself I have this meeting the night before, sometimes I wake up, or most times I wake up before those alarms go off. I think that's amazing. The mind is like,
yeah,
that.
Usually that's how it works. And I will set an alarm if I'm on the road or something and I'm, you know, I'm in different time zones. I may set an alarm because, I don't want, it's partly because I don't want to be embarrassed because I know somebody's waiting for me down in the lobby to take me to an airport or something. And I don't want to be embarrassed, but by setting the alarm for, like, say, 4:30, I wake up at 2:30 and I think it seems a little early. And then I have to look at my phone and it's only 2:30. Okay. Then I wake up at 3:30. So it kind of ruins the whole thing. But, you know, I'm trying to figure that out. But it's interesting that if you, think about things the night before, especially as you're going off to sleep and you're in that theta state, you're saying to your brain, hey, work on this while I'm unconscious.
Do you think most of these problems are solved in the middle of your sleep, or do they happen in that pots and pans building theta period that's kind of goofy, that allows you to introduce and then solve the problem because you're in this magical spot where your brain can put more attention to that problem? Where do you think the problem is solved? In that last moment of consciousness, kind of in and out?
It could be solved there, apparently. But I think it happens throughout the night because we have these, you know, these sine wave type sleeping patterns where we come up to a high level of the subconscious state where we're almost conscious. And then we go into deep sleep where we, you know, and we, there's this REM thing, which, indicates that the brain is in a certain state, and then we're out of it, and then we do diff. So I think it's like the course of the day. We go through periods in different states depending on what we're doing, and if we're faced with a problem during the day, we may solve it at certain times and not other times, and likewise with nighttime sleeping.
Yeah, I think most of the time that I find this magic solution is just as I wake up in the morning, but I never wake up with it in the middle of the night. That's just me. I don't wake up at 2 a.m. with, aha, I've got it.
Yeah, those aha moments are exactly what happens, but I don't think that they happen instantly. I think the aha moments are the accumulation of a bunch of stuff, a bunch of thinking, a bunch of brain function, and then all of a sudden it affects the conscious mind where, oh, I know what you're talking about, brain. And I don't usually wake up in the middle of the night with because I sleep well. And so I think that's abnormal. But there have been times when I've gotten into bed and started going into theta, and a song would start coming out. And then I've learned that I have to get up. Or any idea, I have to get up and put this on paper. Otherwise, I'm going to lose it forever.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. You have to write it down, because you can establish a great theory, a thought, or idea for something you're trying to solve. And then, oh, I've got it. And then you wake up the next day and you go, I had it, and I have no clue of what it might have been. And it was a brilliant, at least in my estimation, a brilliant thought at the time.
Yeah, and a lot of these things are the result of not thinking through, not analyzing, not mathematically putting things together. They're the result of kind of staring out the window at nothing and thinking of nothing, but being in this alpha state or being in this theta state. And that's how I imagined Einstein coming up with what he came up with. He didn't say, well, no, this, you know, all the physics is, you know, this is all wrong. This is the way it should be. It just came as a result of staring into space, so to speak.
Well, and one thing I read about Einstein is he wasn't concentrating on one thing all the time. He had 10 or 12 projects going, and sometimes he would be working on one project, and all of a sudden the idea of how that would relate or thought would come into his mind about this other one. And so he was able to work efficiently on 12 or how many ever different projects.
Yes, we have to be able to multitask. We have to be able to, you know, the human brain is a Renaissance brain. We all have different areas that we should be working in. We all have different hats that we should be wearing. And, you know, I'm amazed that, you know, when somebody says, what do you do? You know, I don't like talking to people when I'm traveling. What do you do for a living? You know, I'm an accountant. how do you respond to that?
Well, what do you think about the number 5? Its shape is kind of odd and peculiar, isn't it? I mean, what do you talk to a number guy about? It's flat on the top. It's round on the bottom. I mean, who came up with the 5?
Well, I'm a number guy, actually. You know, everything is numbers. I mean, that talk about Einstein. I mean, he looked at everything numerically. And when I got into music later in life, I realized how important numbers were, not just to music, but everything else. And I think I've become a better writer. I've become a better researcher because of the music, because of the relationship with numbers, with MAF, for example, which has a lot of numerical relationships. But I saw that numerical relationship of the 180 formula, for example, in a very different way. And as a result, made some modifications in recent years as a result. So, we should be multitasking all the time. And you know, when I was in school, I just remember as a grade school student being scolded because I was thinking of something else while I was listening to the teacher babble about whatever. And you can't, you know, you're not allowed to do that. You have to pay attention only to this. Okay, now we're going to pay attention only to that. Well, that's anti-human brain. That's not how things work. Why do we do that? And, you know, which is why I'm so much in favor of homeschooling, because it's a much more compatible approach for the human brain.
Dr. Phil Maffetone, this is why we love talking to you so much, because, you know, one of my random thoughts that woke me up in the morning was, let's talk with Dr. Phil about listening to the body. And we have not touched on that at all. We just start off and just have dialogue and randomly follow our brain around and talk about whatever. And it's so much fun. And I just love doing it. And we've got to have you on more often than this last time. And we apologize if we waited too long. But one of the reasons is because you were touring and going places. Scott said in the very beginning, we want to talk a little bit about your trip and your music, because that's important too. One of your passions, not only writing books and leading thought and helping people become healthier and enjoy life more and improve the quality of their life, but music is one of the ways that you do it. And Scott, we have a thing called Bonus Miles, something a little extra that we put at the end. And that's what we're going to have on Bonus Miles. We're going to talk about music with Dr. Phil. So Dr. Phil, we're going to now segue gracefully and almost, you can't even recognize, into a Bonus Mile. Is that how we plan on doing it?
Effortlessly.
Effortlessly, thank you. Why was it gracefully? It wasn't gracefully, but it didn't take a lot of effort from you two, but I was struggling over here.
Phil Maffetone, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Get Strong, The Natural No Sweat Whole Body Approach to Stronger Muscles and Bones. It's available anywhere you can buy books.
Dr. Maffetone, as always, you're bringing way to look differently at the things we're doing on the regular.
And if you're interested, we are going to release a Bonus Miles again free to everyone on our normal channel on Wednesday. You can listen to some of the later discussions we had with Dr. Phil. Do we need to say what it's about?
Well, it's really an unmarked trail that we're going to travel on, Scott. We're just going to go by instinct, kind of like this podcast. We're just going to start off running a direction and hope that it's a loop.
And it may not, and it may be about running, it may not. That's what Bonus Miles is all about.
So join Dr. Phil, Scott, and I, and let's take an extra loop. Go out and run.